chapter 22. Would be more becoming in her to behave as other young ladies do on such an occasion as this, especially when she has had the advantage of first-rate dancing lessons. Why should I dance, if I don't like it, aunt? It is not in the catechism. My dear, said Mrs. Gaskin, in a tone of severe check, and Anna looked frightened at Gwendolyn's daring. But they all passed on without saying any more. Apparently something had changed Gwendolyn's mood since the hour of exulting enjoyment in the archery ground. But she did not look the worse under the chandeliers, in the ballroom, where the soft splendor of the scene, and the pleasant odors from the conservatory, could not but be soothing to the temper, when accompanied with the consciousness of being preeminently sought for. Hardly a dancing man, but was anxious to have her for a partner, and each whom she accepted, was in a state of melancholy remonstrance, that she would not waltz or poke. Are you under a vow, Miss Harleth? Why are you so cruel to us all? You waltzed with me in February. And you who waltzed so perfectly, were exclamations not without piquancy for her. The ladies who waltzed naturally thought that Miss Harleth only wanted to make herself particular, but her uncle, when he overheard her refusal, supported her by saying, Gwendolyn has usually good reasons. He thought she was certainly more distinguished in not waltzing, and he wished her to be distinguished. The archery ball was intended to be kept at the subdued pitch that suited all dignities clerical and secular. It was not an escapement for youthful high spirits, and he himself was of opinion that the fashionable dances were too much of a romp. Among the remonstrant dancing men, however, Mr. Grandcourt was not numbered. After standing up for a quadrille with Miss Arrowpoint, it seemed that he meant to ask for no other partner. Gwendolyn observed him frequently with the Arrowpoints, but he never took an opportunity of approaching her. Mr. Gaskin was sometimes speaking to him, but Mr. Gaskin was everywhere. It was in her mind now that she would probably, after all, not have the least trouble about him. Perhaps he had looked at her without any particular admiration, and was too much used to everything in the world, to think of her as more than one of the girls who were invited in that part of the country. Of course, it was ridiculous of elders to entertain notions about what a man would do without having seen him even through a telescope. Probably he meant to marry Miss Arrowpoint. Whatever might come, she, Gwendolyn, was not going to be disappointed. The affair was a joke whichever way it turned, for she had never committed herself even by a silent confidence in anything Mr. Grandcourt would do. Still, she noticed that he did sometimes quietly and gradually change his position according to hers, so that he could see her whenever she was dancing, and if he did not admire her, so much the worse for him. This movement for the sake of being in sight of her was more direct than usual rather late in the evening, when Gwendolyn had accepted Klezmer as a partner, and that wide-glancing personage, who saw everything and nothing by turns, said to her when they were walking, Mr. Grandcourt is a man of taste. He likes to see you dancing. Perhaps he likes to look at what is against his taste, said Gwendolyn, with a light laugh. She was quite courageous with Klezmer now. He may be so tired of admiring that he likes disgust for variety. Those words are not suitable to your lips, said Klezmer, quickly, with one of his grand frowns, while he shook his hand, as if to banish the discordant sounds. Are you as critical of words as of music? Certainly I am. I should require your words to be what your face and form are always among the meanings of a noble music. That is a compliment as well as a correction. I am obliged for both. But do you know I am bold enough to wish to correct you and require you to understand a joke? One may understand jokes without liking them, said the terrible Klezmer. I have had opera books sent me full of jokes. It was just because I understood them that I did not like them. The comic people are ready to challenge a man because he looks grave. You don't see the witticism, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, no, sir, but I see what you meant. apostrophe, then I am what we call ticketed as a fellow without esprit. But, in fact, said Klezmer, suddenly dropping from his quick narrative to a reflective tone, with an impressive frown, I am very sensible to wit and humor. I am glad you tell me that, said Gwendolen, not without some wickedness of intention. But Klezmer's thoughts had flown off on the wings of his own statement, as their habit was, and as he had the wickedness all to herself. Pray, who is that standing near the card room door? She went on, seeing there the same stranger with whom Klezmer had been in animated talk on the archery ground. He is a friend of yours, I think. No, no, an amateur I have seen in town. Lush, a Mr. Lush too fond of Meyer beer and scribe too fond of the mechanical dramatic. Thanks. I wanted to know whether you thought his face and form required that his words should be among the meanings of noble music? Klezmer was conquered, and flashed at her a delightful smile which made them quite friendly until she begged to be deposited by the side of her mama. 3 minutes afterward her preparations for grand court's indifference were all cancelled. Turning her head after some remark to her mother, she found that he had made his way up to her. May I ask, if you are tired of dancing, Miss Harleth? He began, looking down with his former unperturbed expression. Not in the least. Will you do me the honor the next or another quadrille? I should have been very happy, said Gwendolen looking at her card, but I am engaged for the next to Mr. Clintock and indeed I perceive that I am doomed for every quadrille. I have not one to dispose of. She was not sorry to punish Mr. Grandcourt's tardiness, yet at the same time she would have liked to dance with him. She gave him a charming smile as she looked up to deliver her answer, and he stood still looking down at her with no smile at all. I am unfortunate in being too late, he said, after a moment's pause. It seemed to me that you did not care for dancing, said Gwendolen. I thought it might be one of the things you had left off. Yes, but I have not begun to dance with you, said Grandcourt. Always there was the same pause, before he took up his cue. Why you make dancing a new thing, as you make archery? Is novelty always agreeable? No, no, not always. Then I don't know whether to feel flattered or not. When you had once danced with me there would be no more novelty in it. On the contrary, there would probably be much more. That is deep. I don't understand. It is difficult to make Miss Harleth understand her power. Here Grandcourt had turned to Mrs. Davilow, who, smiling gently at her daughter, said, I think she does not generally strike people as slow to understand. Mama, said Gwendolen, in a deprecating tone, I am adorably stupid, and want everything explained to me when the meaning is pleasant. If you are stupid, I admit that stupidity is adorable, returned Grandcourt, after the usual pause, and without change of tone. But clearly he knew what to say. I begin to think that my cavalier has forgotten me, Gwendolen observed after a little while. I see the quadrille is being formed. He deserves to be renounced, said Grandcourt. I think he is very pardonable, said Gwendolen. There must have been some misunderstanding, said Mrs. Davilow. Mr. Clintock was too anxious about the engagement to have forgotten it. But now Lady Brackenshaw came up and said, Miss Harleth, Mr. Clintock has charged me to express to you his deep regret that he was obliged to leave without having the pleasure of dancing with you again. An express came from his father, the Archdeacon. Something important. He was to go. He was au désespoir, he was very good to remember the engagement under the circumstances, said Gwendolen. I am sorry he was called away. It was easy to be politely sorrowful on so felicitous an occasion. Then I can profit by Mr. Clintock's misfortune, said Grandcourt. May I hope that you will let me take his place? I shall be very happy to dance the next quadrille with you. the appropriateness of the event seemed an augury, and as Gwendolyn stood up for the quadrille with Grand Court, there was a revival in her of the exultation, the sense of carrying everything before her, which as he had felt earlier in the day. No man could have walked through the quadrille with more irreproachable ease than Grand Court, and the absence of all eagerness in his attention to her suited his partner's taste. She was now convinced that he meant to distinguish her, to mark his admiration of her in a noticeable way, and it began to appear probable that she would have it in her power to reject him, whence there was a pleasure in reckoning up the advantages which would make her rejection splendid, and in giving Mr. Grandcourt his utmost value. It was also agreeable to divine that this exclusive selection of her to dance with, from among all the unmarried ladies present, would attract observation, though she studiously avoided seeing this, and at the end of the quadrille walked away on Grandcourt's arm, as he had been one of the shortest-sighted instead of the longest and widest-sighted of mortals. They encountered Miss Arrowpoint, who was standing with Lady Brackenshaw and a group of gentlemen. The heiress looked at Gwendolyn invitingly and said, "I hope you will vote with us, Miss Harleth, and Mr. Grandcourt too, though he is not an archer." Gwendolyn and Grandcourt paused to join the group, and found that the voting turned on the project of a picnic archery meeting, to be held in Cardle Chase, where the evening entertainment would be more poetic than a ball under chandeliers, a feast of sunset lights along the glades, and through the branches, and over the solemn treetops. Gwendolyn thought the scheme delightful, equal to playing Robin Hood and Maid Marian. And Mr. Grandcourt, when appealed to a second time, said it was a thing to be done, whereupon Mr. Lush, who stood behind Lady Brackenshaw's elbow, drew Gwendolyn's notice by saying with a familiar look and tone to Grandcourt, "Diplo would be a good place for the meeting, and more convenient. There's a fine bit between the oaks toward the north gate." Impossible to look more unconscious of being addressed than Grandcourt. But Gwendolyn took a new survey of the speaker, deciding, first, that he must be on terms of intimacy with the tenant of Diplo, and, secondly, that she would never, if she could help it, let him come within a yard of her. She was subject to physical antipathies, and Mr. Lush's prominent eyes, fat though not clumsy figure, and strong black gray besprinkled hair of frizzy thickness, which, with the rest of his prosperous person, was enviable to many, created one of the strongest of her antipathies. To be safe from his looking at her, she murmured to Grandcourt, "I should like to continue walking." He obeyed immediately. But when they were thus away from any audience, he spoke no word for several minutes, and she, out of a half-amused, half-serious inclination for experiment, would not speak first. They turned into the large conservatory, beautifully lit up with Chinese lamps. The other couples there were at a distance which would not have interfered with any dialogue. But still they walked in silence until they had reached the farther end, where there was a flush of pink light, and the second wide opening into the ballroom. Grandcourt, when they had half turned round, paused and said languidly, "Do you like this kind of thing?" If the situation had been described to Gwendolyn half an hour before, she would have laughed heartily at it, and could only have imagined herself returning a playful, satirical answer. But for some mysterious reason it was a mystery, of which as he had a faint wondering consciousness she dared not be satirical. As he had begun to feel a wand over her that made her afraid of offending Grandcourt. "Yes," she said, quietly, without considering what end of thing was meant, whether the flowers, the scents, the ball in general, or this episode of walking with Mr. Grandcourt in particular. And they returned along the conservatory without farther interpretation. She then proposed to go and sit down in her old place, and they walked among scattered couples preparing for the waltz to the spot where Mrs. Davilow had been seated all the evening. As they approached it, her seat was vacant, but she was coming toward it again, and, to Gwendolyn's shuddering annoyance, with Mr. Lush at her elbow. There was no avoiding the confrontation. Her mama came close to her before they had reached the seats, and, after a quiet greeting smile, said innocently, "Gwendolyn, dear, let me present Mr. Lush to you." Having just made the acquaintance of this personage, as an intimate and constant companion of Mr. Grandcourt's, Mrs. Davilow imagined it altogether desirable that her daughter also should make the acquaintance. It was hardly a bow that Gwendolyn gave, rather, it was the slightest forward sweep of the head away from the physiognomy that inclined itself toward her, and she immediately moved toward her seat, saying, "I want to put on my burnous." No sooner had she reached it than Mr. Lush was there, and had the burnous in his hand. To annoy this supercilious young lady, he would incur the offense of forestalling Grandcourt, and, holding up the garment close to Gwendolyn, he said, "Pray, permit me?" But she, wheeling away from him, as if he had been a muddy hound, glided onto the ottoman, saying, "No, thank you." A man who forgave this would have much Christian feeling, supposing he had intended to be agreeable to the young lady. But before he seized the burnous, Mr. Lush had ceased to have that intention. Grandcourt quietly took the drapery from him, and Mr. Lush, with a slight bow, moved away. "You had perhaps better put it on," said Mr. Grandcourt, looking down on her without change of expression. "Thanks, perhaps it would be wise," said Gwendolyn, rising, and submitting very gracefully, to take the burnous on her shoulders. After that, Mr. Grandcourt exchanged a few polite speeches with Mrs. Davilow, and, in taking leave, asked permission to call at a friend the next day. He was evidently not offended by the insult directed toward his friend. Certainly Gwendolyn's refusal of the burnous from Mr. Lush was open to the interpretation that she wished to receive it from Mr. Grandcourt. But she, poor child, had no design in this action, and was simply following her antipathy and inclination, confiding in them as she did in the more reflective judgments into which they entered as sap into leafage. Gwendolyn had no sense that these men were dark enigmas to her, or that she needed any help in drawing conclusions about them, Mr. Grandcourt at least. The chief question was, how far his character and ways might answer her wishes. And unless she were satisfied about that, as he had said to herself, that she would not accept his offer. Could there be a slenderer, more insignificant thread in human history than this consciousness of a girl, busy with her small inferences of the way in which she could make her life pleasant? In a time, too, when ideas were with fresh vigor making armies of themselves, and the universal kinship was declaring itself fiercely, when women on the other side of the world would not mourn for the husbands and sons who died bravely in a common cause, and men stinted of bread on our side of the world heard of that willing loss and were patient. A time when the soul of man was walking to pulses which had for centuries been beating in him unfelt, until their full sum made a new life of terror or of joy. What in the midst of that mighty drama are girls and their blind visions? Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.